Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, California is working to implement key provisions of the Affordable Health Care Act, which will make it possible for millions more to get insurance and increase the need for doctors to treat them. We will tell you about a new program aimed at solving the doctor shortage. Plus, Visalia's College of the Sequoias could lose its accreditation, what it will take to prevent a possible shutdown. And the Rogue Festival, the celebration starts this week. But first, the Affordable Health Care Act is expected to expand health insurance coverage to millions of Californians. But with this newly insured patients will come a dire need for more primary care doctors. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin reports on a new type of medical residency program that's intended to train more primary care doctors who will remain in the Valley and work in local community health care centers.
By now, we've all heard there's a shortage of primary care doctors plaguing the Central Valley. So what's the cure? A new type of residency program may provide some relief and change the way we grow and retain primary care doctors in the Valley. It's called a teaching health center.
That's the pharynx right there. You see your teeth. There's the epiglottis and the vellucula behind.
That's Dr. Peter Broderick. He's the CEO of the Valley Consortium for Medical Education in Modesto. On this day, he and a group of future doctors examine x-rays and interact with patients.
Hola, señora, ¿cómo estás? Bien. ¿El dolor cómo está?
Broderick asks the patient about her stomach pain as the young doctor looks on.
¿Y cómo se cayó la comida hoy? Bien.
Bien.
¿Sí, está comiendo suficiente, piensas tú?
Sí.
Broderick works with medical students and residents through the consortium's Valley Family Medical Residency Program. It became the first teaching health center in the state when it launched in 2010 and has trained 12 doctors a year since then. The idea behind this new approach to graduate medical education is to train medical residents in community health centers and encourage them to pursue careers in primary care in underserved areas like the Valley. This new model is funded by the Affordable Care Act. Broderick again.
And so by training and paying for training in these settings, the hope is that more of the graduates from these programs will stay in these underserved settings, will work in these community health clinics, and hopefully redress some of the shortages we have with that population.
The model is gaining traction. This summer, another teaching health center, the Sierra Vista Family Medicine Residency Program, will welcome its first four residents to Fresno. The state's third teaching health center will be located in Redding. This new concept contrasts with traditional medical residency programs, which are often based at teaching hospitals in large cities and encourage specialty training. But traditional programs still play a huge role in training our future doctors. UCSF Fresno remains the largest provider of graduate medical education in the Valley. It also accepts 12 family medicine residents each year. Gene Carlson is the assistant dean of UCSF Fresno. He says the university and the teaching health centers share the goal of increasing the number of primary care doctors in the Valley. But, Carlson explains, there are several roadblocks that prevent UCSF Fresno from growing its residency programs to meet the region's needs for primary care doctors. A major one, he says, is a convoluted system that ties the number of residents to the number of Medicare patients at a hospital. Once this number is set, it can't be changed.
We have what's called a cap that says that based on some historical number, we can only train so many residents, or we can only get funding for so many residents. We can train as many as we want if we thought we could do it for free, but we can only get federal funding for so many residents, and we live kind of up against that cap.
That's where new programs like the teaching health centers come in.
We're not trying to compete with UCSF at all. We're trying, and we don't want to have that perception. We want to understand that this is a different model that we hope will grow the number of family medicine doctors and that there's room for both types of training residents here in the Valley and across the country.
Norma Forbes is the executive director of Fresno Healthy Community Access Partners. Her organization partnered with Clinica Sierra Vista to launch the Sierra Vista Family Medicine Residency Program. She says that the program follows a curriculum similar to more traditional programs, but residents at the Teaching Health Center will gain experience with a variety of patients and procedures instead of specializing in one specific type of medicine.
What we feel the difference will be is the Teaching Health Center primary clinics are considerably different in exposure to an ambulatory clinic that's tied to a hospital. You know, those primary care clinics are freestanding, and they're really focused on prevention and wellness and working with patients from birth to death. And as soon as you get into ambulatory clinics that are associated with a more urban environment hospital, you run into the specialization.
Forbes is confident that the Teaching Health Center model will help train more doctors who are dedicated to serving Valley communities and slowly remedy the region's primary care doctor shortage. In fact, Forbes is hopeful that all of the program's residents will practice in clinics in rural areas of the Valley after they finish their residency. She says there's a high correlation between where doctors do their residency and where they practice afterward.
Our goal is to get 100% of them, all four of them, staying right here so that we truly are increasing the number of doctors through this residency program.
The program currently has a 3-year grant from the federal government. Back in Modesto, Dr. Broderick congratulated medical student Dr. Jules de los Santos for helping a patient reach a healthy weight.
I'm glad to hear he's doing better.
Yes.
Good job.
I'm so excited, actually.
That's right, I'm glad. We've been trying to get this fellow home for a while.
Valley residents can only hope that more future doctors are as excited about practicing in the region. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Well, joining us to discuss this important issue is Carmela Castellano-Garcia, CEO of the California Primary Care Association, a professional organization representing more than 600 nonprofit community clinics and health centers in California that provide health care to primarily low-income and uninsured Californians. Thanks so much for joining us, Mrs. Castellano-Garcia.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. You know, one of the things that we have read about and seen when it comes to healthcare is there has been this effort to establish more clinics in certain areas. But when we talk about implementing the Affordable Health Care Act, we're talking about bringing in millions of more of people who will be able to afford insurance. So what does that mean for California?
Well, the Affordable Care Act is truly going to be a tremendous blessing to California, particularly the millions of individuals who are currently uninsured. And as a result of the Affordable Care Act, will have access to insurance principally through either the Medi-Cal program and for the lower income populations through subsidized care that they will purchase under the health benefits exchange. You do make an important point, though, that with so many new individuals actually becoming insured, that this will put a strain on the healthcare system. We currently represent 900 nonprofit community clinics and health centers throughout the state of California that are already providing care to over 5 million patients. And our safety net system is strained already. I mean, there are many. We're seeing about 1.6 million uninsured individuals currently. We see many individuals on Medi-Cal, and there are serious capacity issues we even have right now. But we are gearing up. Community health centers are expanding with the hope being that they will be able to serve even more individuals who become insured as a result of the Affordable Care Act.
I mean, can you address this issue? Because we have known about this whole issue of having a doctor-physician healthcare shortage, definitely in the Central Valley and throughout the state for years, even before the Affordable Health Care Act. And the fact that healthcare had been debated for a while, and we all knew at some point things were going to change. What has been the barrier, you think, when it comes to having more or the adequate amount of physicians or people in healthcare that we need in this state?
Well, you know, one of the issues that we face, given the fact that we serve a largely ethnic population with over 80% of the patients in community health centers being from ethnic communities and over half being Latino, is not only the shortage of physicians, but certainly a shortage of culturally linguistically competent physicians from the populations that actually need the access to care. So we have an even, you know, additional issue about the diversity of the physician pool. And this is certainly a long, you know, standing issue here in the state of California. Our educational system is not churning out enough primary care physicians, with our medical schools orienting people toward higher paying specialty care. This is certainly a factor that people in medicine are not choosing to go in primary care and the numbers needed. Another problem we have is the retirement of physicians in California. We actually have higher numbers of physicians reaching retirement age in California when compared to other states. So the aging of the current physician population is certainly a factor in the state of California. And when it comes to issues of diversity, as you know, certainly our educational system is failing our Latino children, and they are not obtaining a higher education at anywhere near the numbers necessary, much less getting into medical school. In fact, the data shows that, that we have in California only 5% of our physicians are Latino, yet with Latinos such a large numbers of the population, this is also an issue, of course, here in the Central Valley as well, where you have tremendous ethnic diversity and the needs are not being met. So it is an ongoing challenge, and certainly one of the largest challenges we are going to face in implementing the Affordable Care Act.
Now, legislators, they are introducing legislation that they say will expand the scope of practice for non-physicians, for example, allowing, you know, pharmacists and optometrists to act as primary care physicians. What will this mean, and is that a good decision?
Well, first, I do want to say that one of the hallmarks of community health centers is that we do not solely rely on physicians. Our model of care is a team-based approach, which we have historically drawn upon other providers, such as physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, medical assistants, nutritionists. I mean, we have a team approach, and that's been very helpful to the health centers historically, both in being able to put people with a provider that meets the specific, you know, issues that they are facing, as well as giving them access to a broader array of providers. So a team-based approach is actually a very positive thing and has been embraced in healthcare reform, when healthcare reform embraced the patient-centered health home model, which supports the idea of a team approach to care. So that is, you know, one aspect of the solution is having a healthcare system that relies on all the different types of providers that are available, and then trying to maximize the kind of care that they are able to provide. And that's really what the scope of practice issue is about. Are we actually able to maximize the care that is being provided by these different types of providers? So we certainly think it is worthwhile to explore these issues. The details around this legislation is still uncertain at this time, but we definitely think it is worth considering what the scope of practice options are.
But, you know, there is concern, especially when you take a look at what we're going to be facing, a mass inclusion of people who will now be able to get insurance, thus health care. And this is all happening very quickly. It should start next year. And so people are concerned when you start taking a look at the numbers that we're talking about, just the sheer numbers, and the fact that, you know, some places are more prepared than others. People are just concerned about the quality of health care, and that when you do something like this, there could be room for error. I think that's why some people are kind of concerned about this particular piece of legislation.
Well, the expansion is monumental. I mean, literally, there will be millions of individuals who currently don't have access to insurance who will become eligible for either the Medi-Cal program or, as I mentioned, you know, subsidized care through the exchange. So certainly it is going to put significant strains on the healthcare system. You know, that can't be denied. But there are certain investments that were made in the Affordable Care Act to address this, and I think one absolutely worth mentioning, which impacts my constituency, is an 11 $7 billion investment in the expansion of community health centers. The community health center model was recognized by Congress and our president as a model way of providing care that the Affordable Care Act seeks to advance. And through this investment, community health centers have been provided and will continue for the next few years to be provided with resources to expand their facilities, to open new clinics in areas where they currently don't exist, to expand their capacity, to add physicians, et cetera. And already over $230 million has come to the state of California as a result of the Affordable Care Act investment in community health centers. So there are, you know, some ways in which this law is seeking to expand the capacity, but certainly I think it is fair to be concerned about the strain that having this many more people with insurance is going to place on the healthcare system.
But one thing I think we can acknowledge is that California, because the state had planned not to wait to see whether or not, you know, Congress was going to pass the Affordable Health Care Act and decided on its own as a state that it was going to revamp its whole health care arrangement, therefore putting California ahead of some other states. So I think that foresight, I think when you look back on it, will be helpful for this state, despite the fact that we are going to have this health care shortage.
You know, absolutely. We in California, in the advocacy community, are very proud of the leadership role that California has taken. We were the first state in the country to adopt legislation to establish the Health Benefit Exchange. That organization has been up and running for quite some time. It's really, truly a model for the whole country in terms of the policies and procedures and how it has evolved. We're very proud of that fact. So absolutely, I think California is ahead of the curve now. And just given how huge our state is, what a major significant task this will be, I think you are right that we will ultimately benefit from the fact that California has been ahead of the curve.
And also, when you talk about those exchanges, some information that I had read talked about the state in this region and the fact that they have are ready online already with the exchanges. Now, people can start enrolling in the exchange program starting in October. And California says it is one of the states that's going to be ready for that. Can you explain for people who may not know exactly how this whole exchange is going to work?
Certainly. The exchange was established to be an online marketplace where individuals who will now be required to purchase their insurance can go online to shop for and sign up for their insurance product. So the exchange is going to be a virtual place where we will be able to purchase our insurance. What's important to note is that subsidies will be available for the lower income individuals as well to purchase their care in the exchange. There is another segment of the population, the lower income individuals will be eligible for Medi-Cal. Those individuals will not be in the exchange per se. They will be in the Medi-Cal program. So the exchange is for the other poverty levels of individuals that are actually going to be purchasing their insurance. So come October, people will be able to pre-enroll and through an online support system, and they will be able to be determined what their eligibility is. Actually, whether it's for the exchange or for Medi-Cal, there will be a, you know, one single portal that they can go through for their eligibility determination, and ultimately will be able to sign up for their health care. So it's a very exciting development, although keep in mind there's still some very significant things that the exchange has to put in place, such as this extensive online web-based portal system that, you know, needs to come up and running over the next several months. So there's a tremendous amount of work still to be done, but, you know, they are moving full steam ahead with the goal of being ready come October 1st for this pre-enrollment phase.
And when you take a look at the fact that California has already started the process, when you take a look at the rest of the country, though, in pockets of the country where, you know, this is still being debated, even though it is law, I would just assume those places are going to really have a difficult time when it comes to implementing this because they're so far behind.
when I think about how much work the California Exchange and the Department of Healthcare Services have put in to get to this point, I couldn't agree with you more. The other states that are still debating whether to get involved, how to get involved, are completely behind the eight ball. And as I said, California is really going to be leading the country and will be the model that others will be looking to. And the people who are going to benefit from this will be the people of the state of California. Currently, 7 million without insurance, be able to have access when the switch is flipped come January 1st, 2014, that they will be able to have insurance in a timely manner will just be tremendous for our state.
Now, one of the things also that I've read, it's when it comes to how the rates are going to be set, there is concern that it's going to be done geographically. And people have voiced concern that the rural areas may end up with higher rates than some of the other areas. And I think that is something that's still being worked on.
Yes, absolutely. Rate setting is always a challenging issue, and this is something, you know, that the health plans are going to be needing to work through with the exchange, and there is certainly a lot of concern around that and the data that's going to be necessary for that whole process. So, yes, that is an unresolved issue at this point.
Do you think, when we take a look at where we are with this, what groups do you think are going to benefit the most? I know a lot have been said about, you know, low income and those who are underserved. But I think what we haven't talked about is just the sheer number of people due to job loss who have lost their insurance and those people who have been impacted by the recession. This is going to give that particular group an avenue for insurance, for medical coverage.
Well, I think that's the wonderful thing about the Affordable Care Act. It is really going to assist everyone. And not having insurance is something that affects people in all walks of life and all ethnicities. Certainly, the recession has been an equalizer in that way, with many people losing their jobs at all levels of their profession and then consequently losing their insurance and being unable to afford to purchase it on their own as they remain unemployed. And so we have, you know, that's why we've gone up to 7 million people without insurance in the state. So certainly this is something that's going to benefit people in all walks of life. But I think it does bear mentioning just how much disproportionately impacted the communities of color are by the lack of insurance in the state of California. And this is, you know, best seen in the figure that in California, communities of color represent 60% of the population, but account for 75% of the uninsured.
That's
75%
huge.
Are from communities of color. So certainly they will make up the large majority of Californians who are going to be eligible for coverage, particularly in the Medi-Cal expansion. So I think it's just important to recognize that this will affect everybody across all walks of life, but communities of color are really in the most dire circumstance when it comes to bearing the brunt of being employed in professions that do not provide insurance for their employees.
And how do you think healthcare centers like the ones that you all have established and operate, what kind of role are they going to play in this whole transition?
We believe that the community clinics and health centers have a central role to play. As I already mentioned, Congress and the President embraced the community health center model. We were the only provider entity that received an investment. The $11 billion investment in our expansion, I think, was truly an affirmation of the critical role that we are expected to play in health care reform. And it makes sense, given what I just mentioned about the ethnic diversity of the population that's going to be benefiting from insurance. We are already seeing that population. We are already located in medically underserved communities. We are already located in the lowest income areas of the state. And that's really where the overwhelming numbers of the uninsured reside. So we are very well positioned to be very accessible to them in their community, to be knowledgeable about their specific health care needs as ethnic low-income populations, and really attempt to address the broader not just the specific health care needs, but the broader social needs of our patients. I mean, community health centers have an extensive history dealing with people in poverty, people with severe chronic conditions, people suffering beyond just their health care issues, and health centers are equipped to help individuals with referrals to other services in their community. We really go beyond just the health care needs. So I do feel that the community health centers will be really playing a central role, both because Congress has designated them in this regard, and because they are ready, willing, and able, and just well-located where the communities are at.
Well, thank you so much, Carmela Castellano-Garcia, CEO of the California Primary Care Association. Thank you for joining us this morning and continuing this discussion.
Thank you.
Well, this is Valley Edition. Well, last Friday's surprise resignation by State Senator Michael Rubio caught many veteran political observers off guard. Rubio, whose daughter has Down syndrome, said in a statement that his resignation was prompted by a dire need to spend more time with his family. The Shafter Democrat also used the occasion to announce his new job as a lobbyist for the Chevron Corporation. FM 89's Joe Moore recently talked with Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoke about what Rubio's resignation means politically and which candidates might be looking to fill his seat in the 16th district.
How does this look from the outside looking in?
Well, I mean, this is opportunism. I mean, apparently this job, you know, came along, and who knows when a Chevron started talking to Senator Rubio about this, but this is what we loosely call the revolving door, where you move from government into, you know, basically doing government affairs work for a company or an interest group. And he'll abruptly be in a position where he will now be lobbying his suddenly former colleagues.
What do you feel Rubio's resignation means for efforts to reform the California Environmental Quality Act?
This is a big blow to CEQA reform, because, you know, he was taking the lead on that, and as a Democrat and a member of the majority party, you know, and head of the committee that would, you know, that would look over CEQA anyway, and he had a lot of cachet on this. I just cannot help but imagine that his departure is a big blow to CEQA reform.
Is the climate for reform of CEQA still there? Is there the political will in Sacramento to take on that issue at this point?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, a lot of the state's environmental groups, and frankly, many of the state's labor unions have been organizing against CEQA reform, which means if it was something we were really going to do, the Democrats would have to push back against some of their natural constituencies, which presumably means that a lot of Democrats would not have gone along. Passing CEQA reform would mean probably getting a minority of Democrats on board with probably all of the Republicans. It would be actually kind of a strange thing for Sacramento to do, but I imagine that's how it would have had to have happened. A minority of the majority party plus all of the minority party to do it. And you know, Rubio, I feel, is somebody who could have persuaded other Dems, at least some other Democrats, to have gotten on board. Because, you know, as more of a centrist legislator, you know, he has not only has he ties to the Democrats, he also has ties to the Republican Party somewhat, at least certainly more so than most Democrats up in Sacramento. He was in a good position to have brokered some kind of deal on CEQA. And with him gone, again, I just have to imagine that, you know, the chances of anything happening with CEQA just diminished significantly.
With Rubio's resignation and existing vacancies in other Senate seats, the two-thirds majority that Democrats have enjoyed in Sacramento in the Senate is now at least temporarily gone. What does that mean in real terms for Sacramento politics?
It all of a sudden means that, at least for the time being, Republicans are again a little more powerful in Sacramento, because until special elections fill these seats, and assuming that those seats get at least one Democrat gets in, then nothing tax-wise can be passed in Sacramento without Republican support.
Of course, a newly opened Senate seat means a special election is coming. We're already starting to see people talk about names of potential candidates for this open seat here in Fresno County, which portions of which are in Rubio's district. Henry Perea Sr. Put a Facebook message out saying that he thinks his son, Assemblymember Henry T. Perea, might be a good candidate for this office. How do you see the politics of this surprise announcement playing out? And who do you think are some of the names we might see on the election ballot in a few months?
This is a big and very unexpected opportunity. I mean, anybody in the Valley with political ambition is all of a sudden running around trying to figure out what support they've got. Are they an eligible candidate? Can they raise money? And special elections often benefit people who have some name recognition, who already have an organization, because there's not a lot of time to build that stuff. And that's why someone like your Fran Flores and Nicole Parra, who've already been in elected office, and of course, Henry Perea, who already have name recognition, who have organizations, and in Henry Perea's case is already a sitting legislator, they would have an advantage in a special election like this, whereas somebody new to politics just does not have the time to put an organization together and get the name recognition.
That was Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoke joining us to talk about the surprise resignation of Shafter Democrat State Senator Michael Rubio. This is Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Visalia's College of the Sequoias is facing the potential loss of its accreditation. The news comes after a commission from the Western Association of Schools and Colleges found that COS was in substantial noncompliance with the organization's standards. The committee has given the junior college until mid-October to address issues including institutional planning, student learning, and achievement. Joining us to discuss this important issue is Stan Carrizosa, President Superintendent of College of the Sequoias in Visalia. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share with our listeners.
This accrediting commission issued what is called a show cause order. Now, you have said it is the most extreme response the college could get. What does that mean?
Well, there's a continuum of responses from relatively minor recommendations to things that are a little more serious, which might be placed on warning, to a collection of things that may be worthy of warning. Then you would go on probation, and then at the extreme edge of that sanction continuum is the order for show cause. And what show cause means, it's two words lifted out of a bigger phrase, which means you now need to show cause to the accrediting commission why you should remain open as an accredited institution. So it is the most serious sanction that a community college can receive.
Now, you became district superintendent, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, about a year or so ago.
A little less than a year. I took over July 1st. So yeah. I've been here for one academic semester, and this is now the second semester.
Were you aware of how critical or bad the situation was?
Well, when I arrived in July, you go through accreditation on a six-year cycle. And so 2012 was the sixth year from the last visit, which was 2006. And I'm pretty familiar, having been in public education my whole career, with accreditation cycles. I didn't see going through an accreditation as a particularly unusual or urgency kind of item. When I got here, our report had already been completed. The 6 years for which we were being evaluated had passed. And so I got the opportunity to take a look at the final report as it was being compiled and submitted. And remember, at the same time, I was coming into the community college level administrative leadership, having had a previous life in K-12, so I was on a learning curve of my own, understanding how does accreditation work, what were our previous recommendations, what have been our responses to those. As I read our self-study and our self-report, I was fairly impressed with a lot of what we had accomplished over the last 6 years. Obviously, what we didn't get enough done is in the areas of these five recommendations. And so, you know, the short answer to your question is I wasn't fully knowledgeable of the scope and the depth of the accreditation report, but I was generally knowledgeable and came in ready to, you know, take the accreditation report as a map for our plan of action going forward.
Now, you mentioned the recommendations. What are those recommendations that the college is being asked to correct or do?
Right. We have five recommendations, and they come under two general areas, and you mentioned them a little bit in your opening. One of the standards is the college's mission, vision, and institutional efficiency and effectiveness. And underneath that standard, we have a series of recommendations. They have to do with how our integrated planning occurs. In other words, how does the college plan for programs to be implemented, for courses to be implemented, and then how do they evaluate the effectiveness of those programs and those courses? And then what dovetails in there, at the community college level, there's a requirement for a participatory governance system. So we have to have a system where the stakeholders in the college have a say and have some influence in the decisions and the outcomes. So faculty play a critical part in that. In fact, the Academic Senate, which is an official body in the institution of all faculty members, has a fair amount of responsibility for guiding and making recommendations for the implementation of a majority of academic issues. So that the relationship between this decision-making structure and the integrated planning, how programs are implemented and evaluated, has some disconnects, and that's one of the key areas accounting for two or three of our five recommendations that needs to be corrected, and it needs to be improved, and it needs to be more efficient and more effective. The second area is the student learning outcomes. It's a little bit more explicit, and we have a couple of recommendations, two of the five recommendations in that area. And really what community colleges are required to do now is they're required to write student learning outcomes for each course and then for each program. So if I were an instructor in the science department, each of the different courses that I have to have some prescriptive student learning outcomes. There doesn't need to be dozens, but there needs to be two or three outcomes written for each course. These are the things upon completion of this course that students should know and be able to do. And then alongside that, the faculty members have to create an assessment. They have to write a measurement for that, much like we all do in good teaching. And then they have to give the assessment. And probably the newest part for community colleges is once those outcomes are described or defined, and once the assessment is given, then faculty have to spend some time in meetings afterwards collaborating around those results. What are the results of the assessments that we've given? Is there anything in the data on student achievement that can help inform our teaching, give us opportunities to improve our curriculum, better align our instruction, revise our methodology, etc.? And in that area, we were not far enough along. We've made some progress, but we had not made enough progress. So those five recommendations persisted over the last 6 years, and I think that's the reason that our sanction rose to the level of that extreme show cause order, not because either one of those things independently are institution stopping, but because they were the same things that we were expected to do and were given recommendations for 6 years ago, and we just didn't show enough progress in those areas to even warrant an additional probationary period. So they said, look, it appears that you know, you haven't put the time into these key areas that we mentioned to you 6 years ago. We're gonna make it a more urgent situation for you now. We're gonna ask you to get those fixed by October.
Well, you know, some have said that some of these problems with accreditation really just come from a lack of communication and a lack of data that shows that students are learning. And so it seems like there is a communication breakdown on the campus.
I don't doubt at all that we can do a better job in the internal communications. In other words, collectively identifying what it is we're going to measure as an institution, and then producing the data to show that. And I hate to use this analogy, but almost a kind of a continuous improvement model. You decide what you're going to teach and decide the goals you want to set for the program, and then you implement your strategies to try to achieve those, and then you measure the results. And by communication, we need to have ways for the different entities within the institution, the Academic Senate, the College Council, the Senior Management Council, they all need to be looking at the same data. And we all need to be looking at the results of those goals that we've intended to achieve to make revisions to our plan for the next year. It's a continuous improvement cycle. And then to allocate resources so that we're spending money that is aligned with the goals and objectives for achievement. So I think there's a lot of pieces in place. I don't think that we carried them out fully, and I don't think that we have them well enough connected. So you're on point when you note the need for improved communication and better use of achievement data.
Now, the Accreditation Commission said in its report that there is a lack of trust between the faculty and the administration, which created a poor working and learning environment at the school. What's being done to address that, and how did that develop? I know you've said in your statement that this is not a time for finger pointing, but you want everybody to come together on this issue.
Sure, I guess in any institution like ours, there's cycles of faculty and administration relationships. Theoretically, over time, I think good leadership and good relationships build around core values. There has to be trust and openness and honesty in the communication. There has to be integrity in the decision-making and fairness. And those are things, at least during my tenure, that will take a little bit of time to build. Not too long, but they take a little bit of time to build because you do have to establish relationships. The thing that tends to interfere occasionally is we are bound by law to negotiate and engage in collective bargaining. During good years, and we had a series of good years at College of the Sequoias, from 2006 to 2012, there were pretty high morale years in 2005 and 2006 and 2007. State money was plentiful. Resources were pouring into the college. Negotiations were successful in that the president was able to award salary increases and provide additional benefits and compensation for faculty across the board. So people were generally happy. They were participating in extra activities, earning additional income associated with those. And that was a positive period of time. In addition, we had community support. We had passed 3 local property taxes in our district, each of them to target specific construction projects. One of the taxes fully modernized the Visalia campus. Another of the taxes specifically built an educational center, an extension of our college on a campus in Hanford. And the third tax did the same thing and built a college center, an extension of our college in Tulare. So we have a pretty grand plan that was experiencing a fair amount of success. We were growing as an institution. We were hitting the medium-sized community college marks for extra state funding. But along about 2008, when we were right in the middle of this accreditation cycle, and the budget was starting to crash statewide, by 2010, all of those things that were able to be done collaboratively through sharing resources had disappeared.
Do you think that, are you confident that the college will be able to get this work done, that they will be able to get past this and keep their accreditation?
I absolutely am. We've had a number of heart-to-heart talks with the faculty and the staff at large. The day we got our letter and the same afternoon that it went public, we had a community campus forum, and we had faculty come in, and we spoke to them face-to-face. And again, we're not here to place blame. I think we were focusing on a lot. If you listen to what I just described, we were focusing on a lot of things over the last 6 years, which were very good things. And the board and the administration in particular were admittedly, concentrating on managing hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to get these new facilities built. And in the meantime, the faculty and the administration who were responsible for moving along these internal issues, the communication systems, the decision-making systems, and getting these student learning outcomes in place, just didn't make enough progress. The accreditation team didn't come and find us negligent. We are substantially non-compliant because we weren't able to complete all of it, but we have completed some of it. And so we've got to finish those pieces. We didn't pay enough attention to them. And what we've done is we've asked the faculty to kind of, set aside our disagreements for now, whatever they may be associated with strained negotiations or loss of resources. And now we're not only do we not have money to give, we're actually having to cut. We're having to reduce the budgets and seek concessions through negotiations with employees. So it's a very tough environment. But when you hit a crisis like this and the threat of closing your college is upon you, it really does kind of test the true character of your faculty. And this faculty has responded beautifully. We held our first accreditation task force meeting, a group of 45 faculty, staff, and students that were appointed to kind of serve as the nucleus and guide this response effort. They met last Thursday, and it was an incredibly powerful meeting, and the group of 45 people divided up into smaller groups, each one of them attacking the individual recommendations and the specific standards, and they're reaching out now in subcommittees to go out and get all the other folks from the corners of the campus engaged and involved. They've made a commitment to meet weekly between now and the end of this process. And so we're developing a timeline, a task list, a set of actions that need to be taken. Everybody here is fully committed to maintaining our accredited status.
Well, Mr. Carrizosa, we wish you the best at College of the Sequoias, and thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to allow us to share. And we think that College of the Sequoias has served this region in good faith for the last 86 years, and we have excellent programs and a number of things that are very strong in our traditions and our success. And we just humbly ask that our community stand by us during this time, and we will make them proud, and we will get this fixed, and we will continue to serve our community.
Well, we wish you the best. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, now it's time for The Moral Is. With today's poisonous atmosphere in Washington, D.C., calls for a return to politeness and civility in politics are common. But in this edition of our commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Professor Diane Blair says the real issue is the ability to compromise.
The 113th Congress is the most diverse in our history. Women now make up 20% of the Senate, and for the first time, white men are a minority among House Democrats. Republicans have their first African-American senator in more than three decades. The House has its first Hindu member, its first female combat veterans, and the Senate has its first Buddhist and its first openly gay senator. These new members enter Congress at a time that saw several high-profile departing representatives lamenting an escalating partisan divide. There is a growing consensus that our inability to deal with a broad range of problems is largely attributable to the dysfunctional ways in which Congress operates. Most would agree that civility and a willingness to compromise are essential parts of politics, but the communication climate that has been cultivated in our political system tends towards a rhetoric of fiscal cliffs, stand-your-ground stalemates, and winner-take-all showdowns. Political incivility has its roots in a confluence of factors. Clearly, the political polarization between the two parties is part of the problem. In addition, the growth of cable news, internet blogs, and social networks has led to an abundance of information that makes us feel more informed, but has also contributed to its own kind of political and social tribalism, where we gravitate toward information that merely affirms what we already believe. The increasing role of independent political groups that spend prodigiously on political advertisements has added to the problem by fueling polarization, hyperbole, and incivility. Finally, it's important to acknowledge that politics is not entirely rational, and democracy has never been just about dialogue and deliberation. It is also about struggles over power, privilege, and status. For example, according to a recent New York Times CBS News poll, 85% of Americans believe the two parties should compromise some of their positions to break the partisan deadlock in Washington. But when it comes to specific policy disputes, few Americans want to meet halfway. Just 41% would compromise on the budget deficit. Only 34% would reach across the aisle on immigration. And a mere 33% would compromise their positions on health care reform. How can we expect our leaders to overcome the partisan divide when American citizens appear to have trouble living up to their own stated ideals? Whether or not an increasingly diverse Congress will be able to transform the partisan climate remains to be seen. With growing economic inequality, entrenched political parties, self-interested political groups, and a sensationalized media goading everyone on, it's hard to see how civility will increase anytime soon. A call for civility must recognize that the many interests that make up our diverse society will produce an endless series of confrontations over difficult moral issues and the distribution of resources. Political civility requires more than politeness and respectful listening. It also requires a realization that we must live together and compromise on some things where we differ in fundamental ways. It requires a view of our differences not as an obstacle to the policymaking process, but as a resource to responsible decision-making. For The Moral Is, I'm Diane Blair.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Well, the Rogue Festival, 12th annual Rogue Festival, I think kicks off this week. It's all about celebrating the independent performers and their art. And joining us is Amy Curran. She is an assistant producer of the Rogue Festival and also head of the Fresno Dance Collective, known as NOCO, and Aerials. Thank you so much for coming in today to talk to us about this.
Thanks for
having me. There are people every year who look forward to the Rogue Festival. What can we expect this year?
Well, we're so excited to produce this festival in Fresno and based out of the Tower District. It's also a little bit bled into downtown areas. And this is our 12th year, like you said. Last year we sold over 12,000 tickets, so we're really excited about the community support. This year we have 14 different venues all in Tower District and over 300 performances. So we're really excited for this crazy 9 days of festival.
What can people expect to see? Because like you talked about, it's all different kind of performances.
It is, and it's non-juried, so it's really a risk, you know. So you can find a rogue map, which is what we call these booklets. It's sort of a magazine style. I think there's 46 pages in here. And you can read through the descriptions of all the shows. It's also online at roguefestival.com. And you have as much information as everyone has. Is, you know, the shows are non-juried, so there's not like 4 stars, 5 stars. There's no rating system. And so we just expect our audiences to come and watch the shows they think will be good based on the descriptions and the reviews. And the audience can actually go on the website and review the show themselves. So it's very community-based.
Well, you know, this is not only an opportunity for the community to see all of these performances, but for the people, the performers themselves. This must be a great venue for them.
It really is. And as the director of NOCO, we tour all year long, particularly in the summer. We do all the Fringe Festival tours. And I'm not saying this because I'm from Fresno, but Rogue is really our favorite of any festival that we do because it's the perfect kind of city for this thing because Tower District is all walking distances. So people come, park, and they can walk around. And we like to think of it as a carnival, you know, or fair. You know,
well,
when you come in,
it does have a carnival kind of atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And you come in and buy a bunch of carnival-style tickets, which we call Rogue Bucks, And you get these rogue bucks, and instead of riding rides, you watch theater or dance or music, and all the shows are either 30 minutes or an hour. So it's designed so people can consume a lot of shows, potentially back-to-back, and there's lots of places to eat in between or shop. So I know it's a great opportunity for the performers because 100% of the box office sales goes to each performing group.
Now, the performers, where do they perform?
There are 14 different venues, and they're all based in Tower. The kickoff party this Thursday night is at Tower Theater, and they're also a place where people can buy Rogue Bucks. And so you can sort of think of Tower Theater being a central place, and it's a great place where people can park. People know where to go. It's right next to Roger Rocca's. So you can go and park there and get your Rogue Bucks. And if you walk about, I don't know, two or three streets in any direction, those are the 14 venues. Online, there's a map. And then also on these in these rogue programs or maps that we have, there's a page that has stars on all the different venues. Does that make sense?
Yes. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But I want you to tell me about NOCO, because this the Rogue Festival gives you an opportunity, you all an opportunity, those who belong to this dance group, to really showcase what you do.
Yes. Rogue, like I said, is our favorite performance all year, not just in terms of our national trips, but anything that we do locally. We do a lot of outreach in the schools and in the community, and we guest perform different places. But the way I'm directing NOCO is the only opportunity to see a full-length NOCO show is at Rogue. And so what people may not understand about NOCO is that we work on original modern dance works, modern and aerial. So we work all summer long and build this new piece, sort of like writing a play, and we premiere it at the Rogue Festival to our local audiences and see how that goes. And then we tour it all summer long to all the other French festivals. So for us, it's a really great opportunity because we can afford the space. I know a lot of artists feel that way. It's a little bit more affordable to get into Rogue to get a venue. And that's why we really encourage people to come and see as many shows as you can, because this is really a lot of local artists and talent opportunity to, you know, get those box office sales and get the return on their investment to being involved in Rogue.
Okay, let's talk about the upcoming festival. It kicks off when? Because you mentioned something about Thursday and it goes through.
It kicks off Thursday night at the Tower Theater for the Rogue kickoff party, and that starts at 7 o'clock. So if you are not sure which kinds of shows you want to see, a lot of performers will be there showing little demos of their work. So you can see like a smorgasbord of all the different kinds of shows. And it starts at 7, and there'll be, you know, food and drinks and that kind of thing, a really fun schmoozy party. It ends, technically, the last day of performing is March the 9th, and that's a Saturday. And then we do have one more day of the events, I guess. There's a breakfast the next day that everyone, sort of all the performers before they leave town, kind of get together.
Wow. That's going to go for a while. Now, people really should get, you know, one of these programs.
Yes.
And that will help them as the Rogue Performance and Arts Festival. The program, where can they get these?
You can get these at Tower Theater, at any of the venues. We're trying to distribute them throughout town. We're looking for places in kind of Fig Garden area, river parks. If any businesses are interested in having these available, they're free. We want them in the hands of people. We've been working with River Park this year, and they've been so gracious to have us out there. We have a banner up right now, and so we'll probably be coming out there this weekend to distribute some of these. And but if you look on the website, roguefestival.com, there's a PDF version of this. So for all the web-minded people, they can Google it.
And how much is all this cost us to take part in?
$1 million. And we're going to use it to develop Fresno. Not seriously, but every event is either $5 or $10. And so the 30-minute shows and hour shows. So it's pretty easy and affordable to consume a lot of art. And during this time, the people who are what we call hardcore rogues, they will come in town and literally sleep very little and see as many shows. And we love to hear about it, you know, so you can write us on our Facebook page, Rogue Fresno, and let us know how many shows are you seeing, review the shows, and keep the energy of the arts alive in Fresno.
Well, this sounds great. And hopefully we'll have great weather like we have been having for this weekend coming up. Thank you so much, Amy Curran, assistant producer of the Rogue Festival and head of NOCO, this great dance group, something that looks like we should all go out and just have a great time this weekend. It sounds great.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Amy, for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.